State leaders are projecting Wisconsin will bring in hundreds of millions of dollars in surplus. It's news this week, and we're already seeing different takes from different political parties. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. And we wonder, what do you think? How should Wisconsin spend millions of dollars that we didn't have in the budget? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. That number again, 800-642-1234. State Representative Jim Steinecke is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 5th Assembly District, including Kaukauna. He's majority leader in the state assembly. Representative Steinecke, thanks for joining us again here on the Ideas Network.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You know, the State Legislative Fiscal Bureau says we're projected to have a tax revenue surplus of more than $450 million that's after some is ushered into our rainy day funds. What are the Republican proposals for that money?
Really, we're still kind of working with within our caucuses to figure out exactly what everybody's priorities are. But I would assume we'd follow a similar tax to what we have before. And generally, when the state taxpayers overpay for what their government needs to operate, we tend to return that money to the taxpayers. And I think that's in large part the reason why we've had so much success over the course of the last nearly decade. We continue to cut taxes and we continue to get more revenue into the state coffers. So it's worked out pretty well so far. I don't know why we'd change that now.
If lawmakers decide that that should be returned to taxpayers in the form of a tax cut, are we talking an income tax cut or a property tax cut? You know, where do you see it going?
Yeah, we're still kind of working through that. I mean, I think at this point, all options are on the table. I think you could likely see an income tax cut. I think there is some appetite for a property tax cut. There's also some that want to use part of that money to pay down debt. So I think all of these options are still on the table yet as we try to work through the details.
Do you have a specific preference? Are you leaning one way?
No, not really. I mean, I think the main thing is we want to continue to be responsible with our fiscal policy here. We want to make sure that whatever we do is targeted at people that truly need the tax cut, and will continue to help grow the economy. I think that's the main goals of anything that we do.
Yesterday, Governor Tony Evers announced that he wants to spend some of the surplus tax money on public schools. What do you think of that plan?
Well, I think everybody supports increased investments into public schools. That we've shown it over the course of the last two budgets. We've had record investments in both of the last two budgets. So I don't see why that wouldn't continue in the next budget. But really, I think at this point, with taxpayers having overpaid, I think the main thing that we want to do is give them a refund so we can continue to grow the economy here in the state.
And when you say taxpayers have overpaid, are we talking specifically people who live in Wisconsin, or are we seeing greater tax revenues when it comes to tourism or sales tax, those things where we can't necessarily say the people who live here in Wisconsin have paid in more than we've budgeted?
Well, if you look at where the tax revenue is coming from, it's largely the increase in revenues is largely due to the tax cut that the federal government gave, the corporate tax cut. Under the Trump administration, that's a large part of the reason that we're having the success we are having in the state. So it is state taxpayers, whether they're individuals or corporations.
And you say that, you know, everybody supports increased investments in education. And why would you want to keep that in the general budgeting process as opposed to saying, hey, you know, we have this money. We can use it to give a little boost to our schools.
Well, we have done that. I mean, typically when you're investing in long-term programs that have the capacity to increase the size of government and the cost of government, you do that through the budget process. So you make sure that you're making decisions that are good in the long term. This is something that we've gone through the budget process. Last year, we set out what we wanted to spend, and now we have more money. That just doesn't mean that we should go out and grow the size of government. I think it's something that we should return to the taxpayers.
And let me just clarify then.
Sure.
Do you think that spending that $250 million that Evers proposes for property tax relief and school funding would grow the size of government?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime that you're increasing the cost of government, whether that's at the state or local level, that's going to increase the size, right? And you increase the cost, it's going to increase the size. So, again, it's something that I think as we go through the next budget process, I do think you're going to see increased investments in schools, probably substantially if the economy keeps going the way it is. And I know his goal is to get to two-thirds funding for for schools. That's our goal, too. But it's important to realize for your listeners that we're already at like 65.5%. So we got about 0.5% to go before we reach that two-thirds. That's something that I think we can accomplish in the next budget.
Representative Jim Steinecke is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 5th Assembly District. That's of the Kaukauna area. And Representative Steinecke, you just mentioned that budgeting process and how deliberate it is for planning long term. And yet Wisconsin keeps seeing these surpluses come up. So why does the state continue to take in more than it's expecting?
Because of the policies that we've put forward over the course of the last 8 years that have continued to see investment in the private sector, job growth, great economic activity. I mean, that's what you hope for, right, is that when you budget, that whatever you do through tax policy or fiscal policy, that you see the economy grow and then you see revenues coming into the state grow. That's one of the things that over the course of the last 9 years, Democrats have continually told us that if you guys keep cutting taxes, it's going to result in less money to the state government. Well, that's just not been the case. We continue to cut taxes. The economy continues to grow. And I think we've proven that over the course of time.
And so if it is the case that, as you say, that the Republican initiatives have really spurred this opportunity for surplus, then, you know, regardless of how you handle it this year, is there an opportunity in the next budget then, instead of estimating a little bit lower and getting money back in on the end, if we estimate higher, if we put more money on the front end into things, because at this point we can rely on that economic growth and actually balance the budget by spending more, not necessarily returning money at the end to people. Are you open to that?
No, because our Legislative Fiscal Bureau is the one that does the economic forecast, and they've always been extremely responsible. Because the last thing that you want to do is go out and make major investments that it turns out you can't afford. You have to be more conservative in those estimates, because if you go out and overspend, then the correction is more painful than just having moderate growth in your programs.
And we're almost out of time, but I do want to get your take on whether we should use some of those additional tax dollars that we've seen to spend down state debt. Is that palatable for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that we're talking about in our caucuses, and there is some support for us. We're just going to, like I said, it's going to be between reducing taxes, making some investments in clean water and other priorities, and possibly paying down some state debt.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on exactly how that works out, and I'm sure you and your colleagues will be hearing from us again. Representative Steinecke, thank you for taking the time this morning.
Thank you, and please say hi to the governor for me.
Yes. State Representative Jim Steinecke is the Wisconsin Assembly Majority Leader. He's a Republican from Kaukauna, and we're talking about how Wisconsin should use more than $450 million in an unexpected surplus. And you heard Representative Steinecke reference the governor there. In less than an hour from now here on The Morning Show, Governor Tony Evers joins us. We'll talk with him about the surplus and also welcome your questions for the governor. So, got something in mind? Email us now at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. We're going to talk about water quality in Wisconsin. The Trump administration recently announced a change that removes federal safeguards on certain waterways protected under the Clean Water Act. We're learning about the move and how it could affect our water still ahead. But first, one Wisconsin resident is now in isolation after becoming the first person in the state to be diagnosed with the coronavirus. That brings the total number of cases in the U.S. to 12. The virus originated in Wuhan, China. It's killed more than 600 people there and sickened 31,000. China has instituted massive quarantines, and as the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention seeks to ward off the infections, we're evaluating how the quarantine process works. Patrick Remington breaks it down for us. He's a professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Patrick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing a lot about quarantines out of China. When the U.S. enacts a quarantine, what does that really look like?
Well, that's a great question. It's important to understand the difference between quarantine and isolation. We use isolation in public health to put a person who's infected and has the potential to infect others in a place where they won't spread the disease. So oftentimes it's in a isolated hospital room or isolated to home. Quarantine's a different concept. Quarantine is putting somebody in isolation, in effect, but they don't have the disease. They've been potentially exposed to the disease, so you worry that they might spread later during the time when the organism is incubating, but we don't know for sure that they have the disease. We suspect they do. That's why they're being quarantined, but we don't know for sure.
It feels like if you had something, maybe it's easier to understand why you would be isolated then. I mean, we're seeing entire cities being quarantined overseas because of this concern.
And that's one of the challenges, sort of the ethical or legal question with quarantine, in that a person who has an infectious disease like tuberculosis or the coronavirus, you can pretty easily understand why they would be put in isolation. They're at risk of spreading it to others, and there's a strong legal basis to do that. But quarantine is taking people who might have been in the same room with a person with the disease, or might have been in the same airplane, or might have just been in the same airport. And how far you extend that envelope of concern is a judgment call. And clearly in China, they've decided to be very broad in their quarantine orders to make sure they stop this from spreading. But in a place where there hasn't been much human-to-human transition and where you have a sense that you have the outbreak under control, you could be more limited in the use of quarantine.
When we focus on Wisconsin, are there rules about when health officials can enact quarantine?
Well, this is both the science and art of public health. There are guidelines that the CDC provides, and it would be different for different communicable diseases. But it's really an interpretation of the professionals that we have at the state and local level to use their judgment as to the potential for risk. So if a person was, again, a good example would be in an airport, you might say that the airport is large and that I'm really only concerned about people who were on that same airplane. But if it's a smaller airport, maybe with concern that the person traveled, from the restaurant to the restroom and on, then you might be broader. So it really is contract tracing, that's a really important part of this, to trace all of the contacts of the person who has the disease and then understand what their patterns of travel have been. So it's a really hard thing to do. It's really complex. And you don't want to be so cautious to quarantine an entire community or entire city when that's not necessary.
Because then because you're isolating that whole community of people who may not have been exposed but were feared to be exposed, are then kind of trapped. They're stuck there where they could actually experience exposure then.
Yeah, that you may increase the person-to-person transmission. But I think the general reason not to is it's like crying wolf, that if it turns out that that wasn't necessary, the disease does not spread to any individuals who'd been quarantined, then it means you were too cautious. And the next time, the public may not be so amenable to a public health intervention.
Who has to make these decisions? You mentioned some state and local officials. Who makes the call?
Well, it depends on where the virus is traveling. If the virus is moving across state lines or coming in from our border, then that's the role of the federal government. And the CDC is the is our nation's public health agency. But the Constitution gave public health authority to the states for any infectious disease problems or any health problems within the borders of the state. So if it's an infection within Wisconsin, then it would be up to our state health department. And Wisconsin is a state with relationships with county health departments, and they delegate to county health departments that authority. So it really is within the state a partnership between local and state public health officials, and then nationwide a partnership between state health departments and the federal government, the Centers for Disease Control.
Patrick Remington is professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, and we're talking about quarantines and the difference between quarantines and isolations and who gets to make the decisions, how it affects people. Patrick, what are some of the things that go into that decision to figure out how much of an area or community to quarantine or isolate?
Well, if we were dealing with an infectious disease that we really understood very well, for example, measles, then we would have a fairly well-established principles of assessing risk exposure. Measles happens to be one of the most, if not the most, contagious infectious diseases that we know of. So there the quarantine order may be quite broad to anybody who was in not only in contact with that individual, but we know the measles virus can stay in a room for up to a couple hours after the individual leaves. If it's a less contagious organism that requires really person-to-person contact, touching, or direct contact with a sneeze or droplets, then we might be more cautious. The problem with the coronavirus in this outbreak is that we're still trying to figure out the epidemiology and the infectivity of it. And since we don't know, I think many places are being cautious, assuming that it could be more contagious than it might actually turn out to be.
Let's put the coronavirus in some context. I mean, we know about past outbreaks. We've heard of SARS or MERS. Where are we with the coronavirus and how much of a threat it might be globally?
Well, we still don't know. We do know quite a bit about the other two coronaviruses, SARS and MERS. And through extensive epidemiologic investigations, we found out that they had quite a high mortality rate. For every 100 people infected, SARS might kill 10 of them, and MERS even more, maybe 20 or 25. That's a very serious infection. Right now, I saw as of today, the estimate for the case fatality rate for the Wuhan coronavirus is around 3-4%. But again, that could vary depending on how much more research we do. But in context with the previous outbreaks, it seems to be less of a fatal illness than MERS and SARS.
And when we're thinking about infectious disease in Wisconsin, have we seen quarantines in the past?
Well, we know we've seen quarantines nationally. But the last one was the last significant one was back in 1917 and 18 during the global flu pandemic. I think outbreaks might be handled at the local level and such that there are really small outbreak investigations where you might do this not on a formal way by having a quarantine order, but simply working within the health community and saying if somebody's been exposed, it's better that these individuals stay at home, for example, until we know whether they're going to be ill or not. I'm not aware of any statewide quarantine orders within Wisconsin in the recent past.
Milwaukee public health officials told our colleagues at Wiscontex that they would consider less restrictive means than a quarantine if they could still protect public health. It sounds like those are the types of things you're talking about. What would less restrictive means maybe look like?
Well, again, it's the advice that we give right now to everybody. There are other communicable diseases circulating. Influenza is circulating. So practical things that people can do if you're ill and you're coughing, please don't come to class or get on an airplane. If you're on an airplane with somebody who is apparently ill and looks like they might have a contagious disease, I read this morning the advice is don't sit next to them. If you do, you might be 80% have an 80% chance of getting infected. If you don't, it might be reduced to only 10 or 20%. So I can imagine they're not the most popular people on an airplane today, those people who are coughing and really ill. So the best advice is, if you're ill, isolate yourself by staying at home. And if you're not ill, use common practices, hand washing, good personal hygiene to reduce the risk of transmission.
Patrick, thank you so much for breaking that down for us.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Remington. He's a professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Patrick also talked with our WisConText team. You can read their full article on quarantine online. Just visit wisconText.org. Coming up, we examine a new water protection rule from the Environmental Protection Agency. Our guest talks about what it means for waterways in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll get a sense of how farm groups and environmental advocates are responding. And you can weigh in on this conversation. Are you concerned about the EPA's decision to no longer regulate smaller bodies of water? Or do you think it's the right move and will support industry? 800-642-1234 is the number to call to give your opinion. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. The administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency says a new rule protects our waterways from pollution and promotes economic growth. The Navigable Waters Protection Rule keeps safeguards for large bodies of water already in place, and it removes protections for isolated wetlands and water bodies that are intermittent streams. We're talking about these regulations meant to keep our waterways clean. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we wonder, what do you want to know about water regulations? How do they affect your work or land that you own? And what role do you think the federal government should take in protecting our water, even small ponds and wetlands? And where do you think the state should have authority? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Morgan Robertson is a professor in the UW-Madison Department of Geology and the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. He previously worked for the EPA Wetlands Division in Washington, D.C. He helped draft the 2008 Wetlands Compensation Rule. Morgan, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
The Trump administration announced the Navigable Waters Protection Rule last month. We heard the administrator say, this protects water and it's good for industry. What does it actually do?
It's a significant sort of step back on what the Clean Water Act actually protects. And, you know, the Clean Water Act, 1972, has had a definition of jurisdiction. What waters does it cover? Wetlands, streams, what kind of streams, coastal waters. And that definition has, you know, fluctuated since the early 70s. But this is the most dramatic sort of scaling back of that definition in the Clean Water Act's 48-year history.
And until now, I guess, what kind of regulations or restrictions have been in place on these smaller bodies of water? Because the rule doesn't change it for all bodies of water.
No, there are protected waters under the new rule. I think the most waters that are now not protected that are most remarkable are sort of ephemeral streams. They've always that is streams that run only after rainfall or snowmelt. Those have always been protected under the Clean Water Act. And so you have to remember the Clean Water Act has two parts. There's a program which deals with filling waters of the United States, and that's what we often think of as the wetlands program that protects us from – or protects wetlands from being filled. But there's also the waste program, the pollution program, which prevents industry or anybody else from dumping pollution into streams and wetlands. So when you take a huge chunk of the nation's streams out from under that protection, it sort of creates a situation where, pipes carrying industrial effluent can go into ephemeral streams. And that's, I think, one of the most concerning consequences of the rule.
But if these waters are small, they're isolated, why should we be regulating their use? Because it seems like you're saying this is a big problem if we stop regulating it.
It is. And isolated ephemeral streams aren't isolated. They flow into intermittent and perennial streams. So anything you put in an ephemeral stream, again, it's flowing only during rainfall or during snowmelt, it's going to eventually end up in a perennial stream. Isolated waters are a slightly different question because that would be like an isolated wetland. In Wisconsin, you think of your pothole wetlands and you know, kettle hole wetlands. Those have been not protected by the Clean Water Act since 2001, since the Supreme Court decision. It pretty dramatically changed the landscape of protection in the upper Midwest, where we have a lot of these isolated wetlands. But Wisconsin was first in the nation in kind of doing a fix law to define isolated waters of Wisconsin. So although the change in the Clean Water Act rule doesn't change our protection of isolated waters, it does replace an Obama-era rule, which did protect those isolated waters, which had reasserted Clean Water Act protection over them. So there's a lot of kind of whiplashing of policy going on, and it places importance on Wisconsin's rule.
And I will say, when the Obama-era rules came out, there were a lot of questions about them, even things like, does this mean that the ditch that fills up with water is now something that we have regulated? I mean, they are big, complicated regulations, and I think it's hard for people who don't work in this all the time to fully understand what they mean.
It is, and I like to just recommend that people just sort of skip to the end when they see a new regulation coming out in the Federal Register. I was involved in the wetland compensation rule, which is about 200 pages. Now, the business end is about 5 pages. You know,
okay.
The business end of the Obama rule and the Trump rule is reasonably short. I mean, it's under 10 pages. So the first 95% is prologue and sort of justification review of public comments. One of my favorite parts of the Obama rule is sort of subparagraph G, puddles, where it's sort of listing the things that aren't covered and have never been covered and will never be covered.
Including puddles.
That's just okay. It. You know, you can argue about wordy government regulation, but that's pretty concise. Puddles, ditches, artificial wetlands, artificial, features that under the Obama rule, anything that didn't have a clear bed and bank, that wasn't kind of a naturally evolved stream system, was not covered. It has never been covered. This rhetoric of the Clean Water Act is going to cover puddles is kind of evergreen, and it always shows up in these debates, but it's never been true.
We're speaking with Morgan Robertson, who used to work for the EPA, where he helped draft water quality regulations. And we're discussing a new rule that is going into effect about navigable waters, changing some of the safeguards for smaller bodies of water, isolated wetlands, intermittent streams. And we're taking your calls this hour. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let us know, are you worried about the quality of your drinking water, or do you think the government should or shouldn't be trying to protect our wetlands? And do you think that we can handle it on our own, or that it should be left to businesses and individuals, or do we need the regulations? We are at 800-642-1234. Morgan, Wisconsin sees its share of flooding problems each year. Scientists argue that wetlands can help prevent flooding. Could this new rule affect wetlands?
Yes. Yeah. Now, Wisconsin is lucky enough, as I said, to have had its own wetlands law since 2001. States like Minnesota has had one since 1991. Many states have their own wetland protection laws. But, flooding is one of the main reasons, especially to protect wetlands. When you have increased severity of extreme events with climate change, you definitely have a higher risk of flooding. And wetlands are this kind of detention basins in the landscape that keep our downtowns and our basements from getting flooded. So when, as the recent change in wetlands protection in Wisconsin, the 2018 bill, exempted wetlands in urban areas that are over 1 acre from protection under the Wisconsin law. And those are the wetlands that do the work. Those are the wetlands, the small wetlands in urban areas are the ones that are the detention areas that keep catastrophic flooding from hitting our neighborhoods.
And let's further explain that, because the wetlands keep and hold in the water so that it doesn't just flow across the sidewalks into the basement. I mean, like, the makeup of the wetlands is what allows them to kind of act almost as a sponge.
Yeah, I mean, the word we use in wetland science is detention, which, it is a sponge. There are basins all over the landscape that, again, the word would be sort of desynchronizing flows, meaning the water doesn't all arrive at the same spot at the same time. And it just makes sure the water flows in a sort of, less extreme way to any one point in the landscape. As we lose those small wetlands, water's going to arrive in a much quicker and higher volume way in any point.
But who stands to benefit from no longer having these rules about the small wetlands or the intermittent streams in place?
Well, I mean, if you look at who is kind of pushing for this change in regulation, I mean, the home builders groups and kind of interests around development are always in the forefront of trying to push for a less extensive jurisdictional definition. You know, they're the ones who are building in sort of peri-urban and urban areas that often run into issues of wetland filling. They're not so concerned with the stream and water quality components of the rule, but they do want to, you know, run into fewer problems when they try and develop a site. There's a lot of agricultural support behind changing the rule, and that's I'm always a little sort of curious about where that comes from, because farmers have been exempt from the Clean Water Act since 1977. The exemptions which cover agriculture and silviculture in terms of the wetlands program especially. There are other consequences for farmers filling wetlands that have to do with losing their federal crop program benefits, but that's not the Clean Water Act. It does allow them, though, they do have water quality permits for facilities that discharge through a pipe, so a manure lagoon or any kind of, you know, facility on a farm that would discharge waste through a pipe. And to the extent that they're no longer discharging into a water of the United States, if it's an ephemeral stream, then they don't have to have a permit. And that is extremely concerning, and I can see where that would be a cost saving for the agricultural community.
Yeah, so this rule, it does affect farmers.
Sure. It affects farmers in limited ways, right? I mean, there is this exemption that's longstanding and not going anywhere that really exempts them from large chunks of the Clean Water Act.
Let's bring in a call now. Jen from Markeson is on the line. Jen, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. I would like to mention that wetlands are used for cleaning water. They're the best filter for removing all kinds of pollutants. And small streams always go into large streams. So by defiling any small body of water, we're going to defile larger ones.
So, Jen, it sounds like you prefer to lean in the favor of protecting all waters, no matter how small. Morgan, what do you think about Jen's take?
There is an undeniable logic to that. I used to work in an engineering firm, and I think the only joke in my office was water flows downhill. And, you know, I like to it's
love that that's your joke. Right.
We were engineers. No offense. But you know, the truth is, you know where it's going to go. And, you know, people ask me, why are wetlands so important? And that's kind of like, for candidates, the why do you want to be president question, because there's so many answers, and there's not all of them will work for all people. But for me, wetlands and streams are, you know, they're like the stitches in a piece of clothing or the knots in a fishing net. If you take them out, the whole landscape unravels. So to sort of say, as the EPA has said now, that ephemeral streams, that is, you know, ones that don't flow except in particular circumstances, aren't protected, is to sort of make a distinction that doesn't make sense ecologically or sort of biophysically, certainly not hydrologically, or with regard to where pollution is flowing. And it's a very significant reversal from both the Obama rule, but also the 2006 Supreme Court decision, in which Justice Kennedy was very clear that in order to protect the chemical, physical, biotic integrity of the nation's waters, which is the job that Congress gave EPA, you have to prevent any changes that are relevant to that chemical, physical, and biotic integrity. And that can include things that obviously are dealing with ephemeral streams, but may go even further afield.
We're talking with Morgan Robertson about water quality, discussing new regulations under the Trump administration. Stricter measures were put in place by President Obama, and also the legacy of the Clean Water Act. I'm Keeley Boltina. Your thoughts welcome. 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show. Environmental advocates are concerned that new regulations from the Trump administration open up waterways to pollution. The rule change comes in part to promote economic development. And the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Group supports it, saying it shows the state regulates certain waterways instead of leaving it to the feds. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're speaking with Morgan Robertson. He's a professor at UW-Madison's Department of Geography and used to work for the EPA in Washington. Still time for you to weigh in at 800-642-1234. And now we want to bring Mike from Wanakee into the conversation. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to comment about the regulations and the fact that the regulations are there to protect the public interest. They're there to protect the people from, you know, having their water tables damaged, having everything polluted. And I hear the argument all the time from conservatives about, well, you know, regulations are bad for business. It makes it harder. It makes it more expensive. It should be harder and it should be more expensive to pollute the environment. This water is relied upon for people for drinking. It's relied upon for, you know, for fish so that we have fish that we can catch. It's relied upon for so many things. And you know what? If a business goes under, who cares? But, you know, 50 to 100 years down the line, we're not going to have drinkable water. That's the problem.
All right, Mike, thanks for that perspective. Mike brings up some of the concerns. Clearly, you know, Mike is clear about his perspective. But we do see the EPA's old regulations catching some flack for, especially on these small bodies of water, being too expensive, being unnecessary. I mean, are there some complaints that are justified here?
Well, the authors of almost all of the major sort of pillars of environmentalist legislation in the federal government in the 1970s foresaw exactly that argument and said, yeah, that's right. Actually, if you're causing unacceptable damage to the public good, you're going to have to lump it. There are certain things which simply can't be allowed anymore, and it may cause you to go out of business. I mean, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, these are all written with that expressly in mind. Now, that argument, the door to that wasn't fully closed and has continued to be reopened over the years. And so now we see exactly these arguments that, you know, the very reasons that Nixon vetoed the Clean Water Act and was overridden by Congress was the effect on business, the costs to American industry. And that argument doesn't go away. What's interesting, though, is that the Clean Water Act itself has stimulated a huge business in environmental restoration. I mean, the business of providing credits to somebody who might, if I fill a wetlands because I'm building a housing development, you know, I'll go ahead and get the permit. Probably, but they will require me to replace an equivalent or greater area of wetlands, and that's called wetland compensation. And I can do that myself, or I can go to a wetland banker who has gone out and created, you know, an acreage of compensation that I can then purchase from them and have it be done with very quickly. That business is like a $5 billion business in 2018. That's a huge part of the kind of green economy that is now threatened. You know, what are the bankers going to do when nobody has to come to them anymore for credits? It's not clear to me. And, you know, they've been quite happy to lobby the government in the Bush administration, in the Obama administration, for more extensive regulations for precisely this reason.
Let's go ahead and bring in Lloyd in Athens to the conversation now. Lloyd, thank you for your time today.
Hello.
Hi, Lloyd. Let's try again. It was hard to hear you. Go ahead and ask your question or share your story.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yep, you're good to go.
Okay, I'm a maple syrup producer, and our industry now uses reverse osmosis machines to remove most of the water from the maple sap, which saves a lot of energy. Now, these machines are designed to produce pure water, and that is what we're disposing of and keeping the rest to boil down. I'm now required to obtain permits to dispose of this absolutely pure water. And I was told by an inspector that the reason for this is that someplace, sometime, this water had been put into a stream and had killed fish because it's pure, has no nutrients and no oxygen. I find this hard to believe, but it's a theory. Anyway, I would say that's an overreach by the government. Thank you.
All right, Lloyd, thanks for sharing your individual story with syrup production. So Lloyd is experiencing some of these regulations because he's got a byproduct after he's made something. He says it's pure water, but he has to get a permit to release it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the waste program, and that's handled by the state of Wisconsin. The issuance of these discharge permits is devolved to the states in most cases. It's part of the Clean Water Act, but it's executed by the state. So he's getting a permit from the state. And because we lack numeric criteria, that is sort of exact, numerically precise criteria for most pollutants that could be in industrial discharge, the issuing of those permits is, you know, it's often a matter of case-by-case analysis. Now, I don't know anything about the maple industry, and I don't know what they might have found or why they might have made that decision, but the DNR is exceptionally good at doing this job, and, you know, there's some water quality And that's defined by the state, by the way. The state sets its own water quality criteria. So the state has determined in some way that there's a problem. And, you know, it's hard to know from my perspective what that might be.
We're talking to Morgan Robertson, a former EPA staff member who helped draft and we're talking about the wetlands compensation rule, and we're also discussing changes under the Clean Water Act with the Trump administration, a rule change as far as really small, some isolated wetlands, some intermittent streams. And we're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Morgan, you helped draft the wetlands regulations when you worked for the EPA, and I wonder if you can help us understand more the process of making the rules, because I don't think people always feel heard, and there are these layers of state and federal regulations that kind of get all mixed together.
It was a fascinating process, and kind of a peak experience in a way. I look back on that as a period of just intense professional satisfaction, because the people who worked at EPA and the Corps of Engineers, we drafted the rule together, were just so wonderful and committed and smart and amazingly good at their job. I left D.C. less cynical than I arrived, and that's not supposed to happen. It really is pretty mundane in a way. It's three people sitting in a room and trying to take advice from across the country. We're constantly on, you know, in communication with regional staff about how can this rule not cause problems in Alaska or Wisconsin or Florida, checking in with stakeholders, with congressional interests. I mean, we'd get called to the Hill to sort of, you know, have staffers sort of say, "What's going on over there with this rule?" But it's, you know, it's it really boils down to the commitment of some really smart, amazing professionals who are still there. All the people I worked with at EPA on that rule are still there. There's a sort of sense of like some exodus of expertise. It's not happening in the wetlands program as much as maybe perhaps other areas.
We've had callers talking about, Chris from Juneau is talking about the fact that Chris supports regulation to prevent pollution and runoff, but not at the expense of homeowners and businesses. We've talked about developers. We've talked about farmers. But I really want to understand why people who don't work in those industries or don't rely on those for their livelihood should be invested in these conversations, regardless of where they fall.
Well, we mentioned the public good earlier, and everybody does drink water, I hope. One of the things that, you know, the water system does for us is provide a basic ingredient of public health, which is clean, drinkable water. Wisconsinites get their water from the ground, for the most part. Some of the lakeshore cities get it from the lake. Wetlands especially are the areas where water, you know, surface water enters the ground or is discharged from it. Or in wetlands, as the previous caller noted, are areas where that water is purified and nutrients removed, especially the nutrient pollution problem, the nitrate problem in this state is becoming very, very serious. And wetlands are one of the best natural ways for removing nitrates. So, I mean, to the extent that you're a water consumer or have family issues, especially in rural areas where your well water is not required to be tested on a private well, you should be very interested in the health of the water system throughout the state. It's just public health infrastructure of the most vital kind.
Do you expect we'll see changes to the EPA's new rule? Look into your crystal ball.
I think we're seeing immediate court challenges. I mean, one of the things that Trump administration is tended to do is to issue rules that are extraordinarily vulnerable to court challenge because they've been put together in a somewhat arbitrary way. But the political win has been notched, and then he's quite happy to let policy nerds like myself kind of get very frustrated and fight it out in courts while they move on to the next thing. That's what I see so far.
All right. We'll keep an eye on the courts then. Morgan, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It was Morgan Robertson, a professor in the UW-Madison Department of Geography. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.